Now, Sandy.
I came to a stop and swallowed a glass of Shirley's iced tea in four long gulps. That planted an ice pick in the center of my forehead, and I had to wait for it to melt. At some point, Eddie Jacoboy had joined us. He was dressed in his civvies and sitting at the end of the bench, looking both sorry to be there and reluctant to leave. I had no such divided feelings. I was delighted to see him. He could tell his part. Huddy would help him along if he needed helping. Shirley, too. By 1988, she'd been with us 2 years. Matt Bibicki, nothing but a memory, refreshed by an occasional postcard showing palm trees in sunny Sarasota, where Matt and his wife own a learn-to-drive school. A very successful one, at least, according to Matt. Sandy? Ned asked. Are you all right?
I'm fine. I was just thinking about how clumsy Tony was with that video camera, I said. Your dad was great, Ned, a regular Steven Spielberg, but...
Could I watch those tapes if I wanted to? Ned asked. I looked at Huddy, Arky, Phil, Eddie. In each set of eyes, I saw the same thing. It's your call. As of course it was. When you sit in the big chair, you make all the big calls, and mostly I like that. Might as well tell the truth. Don't see why not, I said, as long as it's here. I wouldn't be comfortable with you taking them out of the barracks. You'd have to call them Troop D property. But here? Sure. You can run them on the VCR in the upstairs lounge. You ought to take a Dramamine before you look at the stuff Tony shot, though. Right, Eddie? For a moment, Eddie looked across the parking lot, but not toward where the Roadmaster was stored. His gaze seemed to rest on the place where Shed A had been until 1982 or thereabouts.
I don't know much about that, he said. Don't remember much. Most of the big stuff was over by the time I got here, you know.
Even Ned must have known the man was lying. Eddie was spectacularly bad at it.
I just came out to tell you I put in those 3 hours I owed from last May, Sarge, you know, when I took off to help my brother-in-law build his new studio.
Ah, I said. Eddie bobbed his head up and down rapidly.
Uh-huh. I'm all clocked out, and I put the report on those marijuana plants we found in Robbie Renard's backfield on your desk. So I'll just be heading on home. It's all the same to you.
Heading down to the tap is what he meant, his home away from home. Once he was out of uniform, Eddie J's life was a George Jones song. He started to get up, and I put a hand on his wrist.
Actually, Eddie, it's not.
Huh?
It's not all the same to me. I want you to stick around a while. Boss, I really ought to...
Stick around, I repeated. You might owe this kid a little something.
I don't know what...
His father saved your life, remember? Eddie's shoulders came up in a kind of defensive hunch.
I don't know if I'd say he exactly... Come on, get off it, Huddy said. I was there.
Suddenly Ned wasn't so interested in videotapes.
My father saved your life, Eddie? How?
Eddie hesitated, then gave in.
Pulled me down behind a John Deere tractor. The O'Day brothers, The spine-tingling saga of the O'Day brothers is a story for another time, I said. The point is, Eddie, we're having us a little exhumation party here, and you know where one of the bodies is buried. And I mean that quite literally.
Huddy and Shirley were there. They can...
Yeah, they were. George Morgan was there, too, I think.
He was, Shirley said quietly. But so what? I still had my hand on Eddie's wrist, and I had to fight a desire to squeeze it again, hard. I liked Eddie, always had. And he could be brave, but he also had a yellow streak. I don't know how those two things can exist side by side in the same man, but they can. I've seen it more than once. Eddie froze back in 96, on the day Travis and Tracy O'Day started firing their fancy militia machine guns out their farmhouse windows. Kurt had to break cover and yank him to safety by the back of his jacket. And now, here he was trying to squiggle out of his part of the other story, the one in which Ned's father had played such a key role. Not because he'd done anything wrong. He hadn't. But because the memories were painful and frightening. Sandy, I really ought to get toddling. I got a lot of chores that I've been putting off, and we've been telling this boy about his father, I said. And what I think you ought to do, Eddie, is sit there quiet, maybe have a sandwich and a glass of iced tea, and wait until you have something to say. He settled back on the end of the bench and looked at us. I know what he saw in the eyes of Kurt's boy. Puzzlement and curiosity. We'd become quite a little council of elders, though, surrounding the young fella, singing him our warrior songs of the past. And what about when the songs were done? If Ned had been a young Indian brave, he might have been sent out on some sort of dream quest, kill the right animal, have the right vision while the blood of the animal's heart was still smeared around his mouth, come back a man. If there could be some sort of test at the end of this, I reflected, some way in which Ned could demonstrate new maturity and understanding, things might have been a lot simpler. But that's not the way things work nowadays, at least not by and large. These days, it's a lot more about how you feel than what you do. And I think that's wrong. And what did Eddie see in our eyes? Resentment? A touch of contempt? Perhaps even the wish that it had been him who had flagged down the truck with the flapper rather than Curtis Wilcox? That it had been him who had gotten turned inside out by Bradley Roach? Always almost overweight Eddie Jackaboy, who drank too much and would probably be making a little trip to Scranton for a 2-week stay in the member assistance program if he didn't get a handle on his drinking soon. The guy who was always slow filing his reports and who almost never got the punchline of a joke unless it was explained to him. I hope he didn't see any of those things because there was another side to him, a better side. But I can't say for sure he didn't see at least some of them, maybe even all of them. About the big picture? I turned to Ned, glad to be diverted from the uncomfortable run of my own thoughts. Come again? I asked if you ever talked about what the Buick really was, where it came from, what it meant. If you ever discussed, you know, the big picture. Well, there was the meeting at the Country Way, I said. I didn't quite see where he was going. I told you about that. Yeah, but that one sounded, you know, more administrative than anything else. You do okay in college, Archie said and patted him on the knee. Any kid can say a word like that, just roll it out, he bound to do okay in college. Ned grinned. Administrative, organizational, bureaucratized, compartmentalized? Quit showing off, kiddo, Huddy said. You're giving me a headache. Anyway, the thing at the Country Way is not the kind of meeting I'm talking about. You guys must have, I mean, as time went on, you must have. I knew what he was trying to say, and I knew something else at the same time. The boy would never quite understand the way it had really been, how mundane it had been, at least on most days. On most days, we had just gone on. The way people go on after seeing a beautiful sunset or tasting a wonderful champagne or getting bad news from home. We had the miracle of the world out behind our workplace, but that didn't change the amount of paperwork we had to do or the way we brushed our teeth or how we made love to our spouses. It didn't lift us to new realms of existence or planes of perception. Our asses still itched and we still scratched them when they did. I imagine Tony and your father talked it over a lot, I said. But at work, at least for the rest of us, the Buick gradually slipped into the background like any other inactive case. Inactive? He nearly shouted it and sounded so much like his father it was frightening. It was another chain, I thought, this resemblance between father and son. The chain had been mangled, but it wasn't broken. For long periods of time it was, I said. Meantime, there were fender benders and hit and runs and burglaries and dope and the occasional homicide. The look of disappointment on Ned's face made me feel bad, as if I'd let him down. Ridiculous, I suppose, but true. Then something occurred to me. I can remember one bull session about it. It was at
the picnic, Phil Candleton finished. Labor Day picnic. That's what you're thinking about, right?
I nodded.
1979. The old Academy soccer field down by Redfern Stream. We all liked the Labor Day picnic a lot better than the one on the 4th of July, partly because it was a lot closer to home and the men who had families could bring them, but mostly because it was just us, just Troop D. The Labor Day picnic really was a picnic. Phil put his head back against the boards of the barracks and laughed.
Man, I'd almost forgotten about it. We talked about that damn yonder Buick kid and just about nothing else. More we talked, the more we drank. My head ached for 2 days after.
Huddy said, that picnic's always a good time.
You were there last summer, weren't you, Ned?
Summer before last, Ned said. Before Dad died. He was smiling.
That tire swing that goes out over the water, Paul Loving fell out of it and sprained his knee.
We all laughed at that. Eddie as loud as the rest of us. A lot of talk, not one single conclusion, I said.
But what conclusions could we draw? Only one, really. When the temperature goes down inside that shed, things happen. Except even that turned out not to be a hard and fast rule.
Sometimes, especially as the years went by, the temperature would go down a little, then rebound. Sometimes that humming noise would start, and then it would stop again, just cut out as if someone pulled the plug on a piece of electrical equipment. Ennis disappeared with no light show, and Jimmy the Gerbil disappeared after a humongous light show, and Rosalind didn't disappear at all.
Did you put her back into the Buick? Ned asked.
Nah, Phil said. This is America, kid. No double jeopardy.
Rosalind lived the rest of her life upstairs in the common room, I said. She was 3 or 4 when she died. Tony said that was a fairly normal lifespan for a gerbil.
Did more things come out of it? Out of the Buick?
Yes, but you couldn't correlate the appearance of those things with...
What sort of things? What about the bat? Did my father ever get around to dissecting it? Can I see it? Are there pictures, at least? Was it...
Whoa, hold on, I said, raising my hand.
Eat a sandwich or something. Chill out.
He picked up a sandwich and began to nibble, his eyes looking at me over the top. For just a moment he made me think of Rosalind the gerbil turning to look into the lens of the video camera, eyes bright and whiskers twitching.
Things appeared from time to time, I said. And from time to time things, living things, would disappear. Frogs, a butterfly, a tulip right out of the pot it was growing in.
But you couldn't correlate the chill, the hum, or the light shows with either the disappearances or what your dad called the Buick's miscarriages. Nothing really correlates. The chill is pretty reliable. There's never been one of those fireworks displays without a preceding temperature drop. But not every temperature drop means a display. You see what I mean?
I think so, Ned said. Clouds don't always mean rain, but you don't get rain without them.
I couldn't have put it more neatly, I said.
Huddy tapped Ned on the knee.
You know how folks say there's an exception to every rule? Well, in the case of the Buick, we got about one rule and a dozen exceptions. The driver himself is one, you know, the guy in the black coat and the black hat. He disappeared, but not from the vicinity of the Buick.
Can you say that for sure? Ned asked.
It startled me. For a boy to look like his father is natural. To sound like his father, too, but for a moment there, Ned's voice and looks combined to make something more than a resemblance. Nor was I the only one who felt that. Shirley and Arky exchanged an uneasy glance.
What do you mean? I asked him.
Roach was reading a newspaper, wasn't he? And from the way you described him, that probably took most of his concentration.
So how do you know the guy didn't come back to his car?
I'd had something like 20 years to think about that day and the consequences of that day. 20 years. And the idea of the roadmaster's driver coming back, perhaps even sneaking back, had never once occurred to me, or, so far as I knew, to anyone else. Brad Roach said the guy hadn't returned, and we'd simply accepted that. Why? Because cops have built-in bullshit detectors, and in that case, none of the needles swung into the red. Never even twitched, really. Why would they? Brad Roach at least thought he was telling the truth. That didn't mean he knew what he was talking about, though. I guess that it's possible, I said. Ned shrugged as if to say, well, there you go. We never had Sherlock Holmes or Lieutenant Columbo working out a D-troop, I said. I thought I sounded rather defensive. I felt rather defensive. When you get right down to it, we're just the mechanics of the legal system. Blue-collar guys who actually wear gray collars and have a slightly better-than-average education. We can work the phones, compile evidence if there's evidence to compile, make the occasional deduction. On good days, we can make fairly brilliant deductions. But with the Buick, there was no consistency. Hence, no basis for deduction, brilliant or otherwise. Some of the guys thought it came from space, Huddy said. That it was, oh, I don't know, a disguised scout ship or something. They had the idea Ennis was abducted by an E.T. disguised to look at least passably human in his, its, black coat and hat. This talk was at the picnic, the Labor Day picnic, okay? Yeah, Ned said. That was one seriously weird get-together, kiddo, Huddy said. It seems to me that everyone got a lot drunker than usual and a lot faster, but no one got rowdy, not even the usual suspects like Jackie O'Hara and Christian Soder. It was very quiet, especially once the shirts and skins touch football game was over. I remember sitting on a bench under an elm tree with a bunch of guys, all of us moderately toasted, listening to Brian Cole tell about these flying saucer sightings around the power lines in New Hampshire, only a few years before that was, and how some woman claimed to have been abducted and had all these probes stuck up inside her, entrance ramp and exit ramp both. Is that what my father believed? That aliens abducted his partner? No, Shirley said. Something happened here in 1988 that was so outrageous and beyond belief. So fucking awful. What? Ned asked. For God's sake, what? Shirley ignored the question. I don't think she even heard it. A few days afterward, I asked your father flat out what he believed. He said it didn't matter. Ned looked as if he hadn't heard her correctly. It didn't matter? That's what he said. He believed that whatever the Buick was, it didn't matter in the great scheme of things, in that big picture you were talking about. I asked him if he thought someone was using it maybe to watch us, if it was some sort of television. And he said, I think it's forgotten. I still remember the flat, certain way he said it, as if he was talking about, I don't know, something as important as a king's treasure buried under the desert since before the time of Christ, or something as unimportant as a postcard with the wrong address sitting in a dead letter file somewhere. Having a wonderful time, wish you were here, who cares? Because all that was long, long ago. It comforted me and at the same time chilled me to think anything so strange and awful could just be forgotten, misplaced, overlooked. I said that, and your dad, he laughed. Then he flapped his arm at the western horizon and said, Shirley, tell me something. How many nuclear weapons do you think this great nation of ours has got stored out there in various places between the Pennsylvania-Ohio line and the Pacific Ocean? And how many of them do you think will be left behind and forgotten over the next two or three centuries? We were all silent for a moment, thinking about this. I was considering quitting the job, Shirley said at last. I couldn't sleep. I kept thinking about poor old Mr. Dillon, and in my mind, quitting was almost a done deal. It was Kurt who talked me into staying, and he did it without even knowing he was doing it. I think it's forgotten, he said. And that was good enough for me. I stayed, and I've never been sorry either. This is a good place. Most of the guys who work here are good troops. That goes for the ones who are gone, too. Like Tony.
I love you, Shirley. Marry me, Huddy said.
He put an arm around her and puckered his lips. Not a pretty sight, all in all.
She elbowed him. You're married already, foolish.
Eddie J. spoke up then.
If your dad believed anything, it was that yonder machine came from some other dimension.
Another dimension? You're kidding. He looked at Eddie closely. No, you're not kidding.
And he didn't think it was planned at all, Eddie went on. Not, you know, like you'd plan to send a ship across the ocean or a satellite into space. In some ways, I'm not even sure he thought it was real.
You lost me, the kid said.
Me too, Shirley agreed.
He said, Eddie shifted on the bench. He looked out again at the grassy place where Shed A had once stood. This was at the O'Day farm, if you want to know the truth. That day, you have to realize we were out there almost 7 goddamn hours, parked in the corn and waiting for those 2 dirtbags to come back. Cold, couldn't run the engine, couldn't run the heater. We talked about everything, hunting, fishing, bowling, our wives, our plans. Kurt said he was going to get out of the PSP in another 5 years.
He said that?
Ned was round-eyed.
Eddie gave him an indulgent look.
From time to time we all say that, kid, just like all the junkies say they're going to quit the spike. I told him how I'd like to open my own security business in the burg, also how I'd like to get me a brand new Winnebago. He told me about how he wanted to take some science courses at Horlicks and how he was getting resistance from your mom. She said it was their job to put the kids through school, not him. He caught a lot of flack from her, but never blamed her, because she didn't know why he wanted to take those courses, what had got him interested. And he couldn't tell her. That's how we got around to the Buick. And what he said, I remember this clear as the sky on a summer morning, was that we saw it as a Buick because we had to see it as something, Ed muttered. He was leaning forward and rubbing the center of his forehead with 2 fingers like a man with a headache.
You look as confused as I felt, but I did sort of understand what he meant.
In here. Eddie tapped his chest above his heart. Ned turned back to me.
Sandy, that day at the picnic, did any of you talk about...
He trailed off without finishing.
Talk about what? I asked him.
He shook his head, looked down at the remains of his sandwich, and popped the last bite into his mouth.
Never mind. Isn't important. Did my dad really dissect the bat thing you guys found?
Yep. After the second light show, but before the Labor Day picnic, he...
Tell the kid about the leaves, Phil said. You forgot that part.
And I had. Hell, hadn't even thought about the leaves in 6 or 8 years.
You tell him, I said. You're the one who had your hands on him.
Phil nodded, sat silent for a few moments, and then began to speak staccato, as if giving a report to a superior officer.